Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, 30% of renters in the United States could not pay their rent, according to Apartment List. The percentage will probably be much higher this month. Dozens of eviction moratoriums across the United States have kept renters in their homes, but now many bans have expired or are going to expire throughout the summer. Across the country, courts are reopening and processing evictions. Diane Yentl, CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, calls it shocking and unconscionable. As millions of people are still out of work and the additional $600 weekly unemployment benefit is set to expire at the end of this month, advocates and researchers say the U.S. is about to enter a massive eviction crisis. The analytics firm Amherst estimates that 28 million people are at risk of becoming evicted because of job losses tied to the pandemic. The people most likely to be evicted are those in vulnerable financial circumstances, communities of color, single moms, people with disabilities, formerly incarcerated people, and undocumented people. Joining us to talk about this crisis and what can be done about it is Aliza Durana, a journalist and media strategist with Princeton University's Eviction Lab. That's a research team that published the first data set of evictions. The team's eviction tracking system monitors eviction hotspots due to the pandemic. Hi, Aliza. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I think it's important to start off by first saying that even before the COVID pandemic, evictions were a major problem because across the country, rents have been increasing while wages are stagnant. So can you first talk about that?
Absolutely. So you hit the nail on the head. You know, even prior to COVID-19, we were in the midst of the worst housing crisis we've seen in the last century. So, you know, as late as 2016, we were seeing 3.7 million eviction filings annually, or roughly 7 filings per minute. And, you know, those are just the legal filings. Our data does not capture any informal or illegal evictions that might be happening around the country. And evictions are a traumatic and devastating event. So we're absolutely concerned that now that, you know, 1 in 4 U.S. residents is unemployed, that we're about to see an avalanche of evictions and spike in homelessness.
So that was in 2017, 7 eviction filings every minute?
Yep, in 2016. And, you know, what we're currently tracking evictions live in a number of U.S. cities and in places where the eviction moratoriums have been lifted. You know, we're already starting to see record numbers of eviction filings. And actually, you know, Milwaukee, Wisconsin is maybe one place to look, a possible canary in the coal mine. And they lifted their moratorium in late May, and we've already, you know, surpassed average filing rates in that city.
And it is such a patchwork of laws really happening across the country, because we did a lot of searching last night. The local media are doing a really good job of reporting on this. So just to give a couple of examples, and it goes both ways. Some cities and states are getting rid of their moratoriums and some are extending them. So San Diego's city council approved a moratorium until September 30th. Atlanta extended a moratorium through the end of August. Clark County, Nevada said their moratorium will end on September 1st. Moratorium in Arizona is going to end on July 22nd. And then to your point about what's happening right now in Louisiana, the moratorium ended on June 15th. In New Orleans, the eviction rate is twice the national average. The Southeast Louisiana Legal Services has seen a 100% increase in their eviction cases. So it really is a patchwork of rules happening across the country.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people think that as soon as the pandemic hit, that they were, you know, possibly protected from eviction, but it really has depended on where you live. You know, if you're lucky enough to be a resident of Massachusetts, you know, the state of Massachusetts has had a comprehensive eviction moratorium in place for several months now. And there, you know, we've seen little to no legal evictions, but in places like Oklahoma, where there was no moratorium in place, evictions have been ongoing since March. And again, to really devastating consequences to the, you know, families and communities in question through no fault of their own.
So let's talk about what these moratoriums actually mean. As you said, a number of states and cities put these moratoriums in place. What does that actually mean for renters?
Sure. So an eviction is an involuntary move whereby a landlord ejects a renter or a tenant from their home. And it usually happens in roughly three steps. So the first part of the process is the initiation of an eviction by a landlord. They file with the court system, and they often have to provide a tenant with notice that they're filing an eviction, but not always. The second part of the process relates to the court procedures around evictions. And the third part relates to the enforcement of an eviction order or judgment by local law enforcement. And, you know, the states that have been doing the best in terms of their, you know, stopgap measures and supports are places like Massachusetts and Connecticut and Delaware, where the state has effectively frozen all three steps in that process. But there are other states and you know, localities where, let's say, the court has been shut down, but filings are still ongoing. So, you know, in a situation like that, a tenant actually could be under a great deal amount of stress, worrying about, you know, when that eviction is going to move forward.
And again, going back to the patchwork, just to give a couple more examples, here in San Francisco, Mayor London Breed first declared an eviction moratorium in mid-March. It halted evictions beginning in April. It was set to expire this month. The city of San Francisco has extended it indefinitely, but landlord and realtor groups have filed a lawsuit to suspend it. So are you also seeing these kinds of landlord and realtor lawsuits happening across the country?
Absolutely. You know, we're seeing landlord and realtor associations file suits in both against states and also against municipal governments across the country. And, you know, in certain places where, let's say, you know, there are blue cities and red states, we're also seeing states try and preempt or block local eviction moratoria. And we're particularly seeing that in the southern United States, and I'm thinking of Texas in particular, but not exclusively. So really, you know, depends on that lottery of where you live, which is absolutely unfair and devastating for those who are facing an eviction right now.
Right. I was also watching a couple of interviews with mom and pop landlords, and there have also been pushes for moratoriums for people who actually own homes. Can you give us any updates on that?
Sure. So there are more protections in place from foreclosure, which is, you know, when a lender or bank takes back ownership of a home due to non-payment of a mortgage. You know, the protections for homeowners are much more extensive than the protections for renters, but it really varies from state to state. So, you know, we absolutely are concerned about the well-being of mom and pop landlords. You know, however, we also know that the profits that landlords make from rentals are actually highest in our lowest income communities. So as we have these conversations around, you know, what bills need to get paid, how can we keep, you know, tenants safely sheltering in place, I think, you know, that should absolutely be a part of the calculus of any policy response as we weather this pandemic.
And according to many studies, the lowest income communities are going to be hit the hardest by this, along with undocumented people, formerly incarcerated people, people with disabilities, single moms. This is going to hit just such a wide range of people.
Absolutely. You know, we know from our data that Black and brown communities are, you know, disproportionately impacted by eviction through no fault of their own. So even when, you know, we control for things like income or education, you know, Communities of color are still disproportionately impacted by eviction. And Black mothers in particular are, and that is absolutely a legacy of racism and discrimination in our policies and culture. In addition to that, we have been receiving reports of, landlords threatening to call ICE on tenants who don't want to vacate their apartments. So, we're both concerned about the legal evictions that people are facing, as well as illegal pressures that our historically marginalized communities might be facing at this point in time.
And to that point, immigrant and renter advocates in cities across the country say they're being inundated with complaints about landlords pressuring tenants to pay rent money. The New York Times reporter Caitlin Dickerson had a piece over the weekend. She spoke with Wilfredo Avila and his girlfriend Patricia Carrillo, and they could not pay their one-room sublet rent for their one-room sublet in Washington, D.C. after they lost their jobs. And even though there was an eviction ban in place in D.C., their landlord threatened to threaten them. They feared that they would be deported, and so they decided to just flee. I mean, do we have any idea how pervasive this is?
We know from survey data that, or we suspect also, it's quite difficult to study an illegal phenomenon. But, that being said, we do have survey data showing that illegal and informal evictions are happening at roughly double the rate of legal filings. So when I said at the top of the call that, we saw 3.7 million filings in 2016, we suspect that illegal experiences are happening at double that rate. So, unfortunately, I suspect that, the experience that Caitlin Dickerson highlighted in her story is probably common. And, for many renters, just cobbling together first and last month's rent is a challenge. And, particularly for communities that have faced violence by the state, going to court to challenge harassment or illegal behavior by a landlord is overwhelming. And, sometimes the most rational thing to do in that situation is to leave, which is unfair and devastating to those families.
Right. The article by Caitlin Dickerson also says that a lot of undocumented immigrants do not have a, quote, formal lease. They've got handshake agreements with their landlords. According to Jennifer Berger with the Attorney General's office in D.C., in one apartment building, landlords posted signs in Spanish announcing that tenants who missed rent payments could be evicted immediately. The Attorney General has collected at least 165 complaints of illegal evictions and late fees and sent 38 cease and desist letters to landlords since April. How common is this nationwide? On Twitter, there's so many now cases of illegal evictions. And we saw, I believe you just tweeted this actually, that Texas landlords are filing hundreds of illegal evictions. This is a piece from the Texas Observer.
Yeah. So, I mean, to your question, the Federal CARES Act that passed in April actually, forbade landlords who have a federally backed mortgage from evicting people. And, we estimate that that is about a third of the rental market. But unfortunately, because, there is not a lot of money or support to enforce bans like that, what we have seen, and to the point about the Texas Observer story, is that landlords who in theory should not be allowed to file an eviction during this time are still doing so. And the fact that we're seeing those cases in the court system really indicates to me that it's likely happening on a larger scale, particularly in our immigrant communities. So, as we think through, policies and resolutions that, we can take during this time to, support our communities, we absolutely have to, remember that these sorts of informal or illegal, harassing behaviors are probably ongoing and that we need to head them off.
Right. And to your point about the CARES Act, it halted evictions for people living in properties with federally backed mortgages. According to the PBS NewsHour, that only applies to one third of renters, and it's expected to expire on July 31st. Today, we are talking about what it will take to keep people in their homes. Now that so many of these eviction moratoriums are ending, there is a possibility that up to 20 8 million renters could be evicted. If you have a question or a story to share what is happening in your area, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Today, we are joined by Aliza Durana, a journalist and media strategist with Princeton University's Eviction Lab. It's a research team that published the first data set of evictions. The team's eviction tracking system monitors eviction hotspots due to COVID. Another story that I wanted to share, the PBS NewsHour had a really great piece yesterday, and they focused on Rhonda Anderson. She works 70 hours a week as the head cook at a North Charleston nursing home. She still can't make rent, so she and her family were evicted. They are a Black family. Her husband lost his job due to COVID. They found another place, but they have to live in a hotel for 8 days until it's available. You know, what's so hard about this, Aliza, and I'm so glad you brought up past policies like redlining, for example, in so many cases, families like Rhonda's have no choice but to just move from home to home to home. And this is so incredibly stressful for families. This is also going to become yet another public health crisis.
Absolutely. You know, I think for those of your listeners who don't necessarily know that much about eviction, I think it's important to remember that, you know, this is an experience in which families and communities lose their home. They might come home and find that the locks have been changed, or that all of their belongings are on the front lawn, and that all of a sudden, you know, you have to worry about how to, you know, provide a roof over your head or that of your children. And it, you know, often triggers job loss, experiences of homelessness. It affects mental and physical well-being, both in adults and children. It, you know, understandably makes it difficult for, you know, children to learn and do well in school. So it really, you know, triggers a cascading, you know, pattern of negative events. And, you know, while I haven't seen, you know, that segment yet, I, you know, it really also is a reminder that, you know, there are essential jobs in this country, like those of home health aides, childcare workers, who for too long have been making poverty wages without access to healthcare and other benefits. And that is, you know, partially because we undervalue the role that they play in our society. And it's partially also due to the fact that those jobs have historically been done by communities of color in the United States. So, you know, these patterns of inequality are reproducing themselves and deepening. And, you know, if I'm being optimistic, we now have an opportunity to rectify that as we move forward. But, you know, we really, you know, need to respond with generous policy supports right now.
Right. And when you think about families, especially as kids have not been in school, which puts so much more pressure on the family. And we're now hearing that in some cases, schools might not open in the fall. So we are in for another, gosh, 6 months of pretty deep stress. And I just want to mention that at KALW.org, we have a whole resource page with various resources. We're going to be doing a whole series on mental health, because this is just really hard on families, especially these kids who are not in school. And then they have mom and dad are stressed because they're losing their jobs, and then they have to move from home to home. So it's just, it's really, really difficult. So if you need any resources, please visit our resource page at kalw.org. I also want to mention, and this is getting some attention on social media, All Things Considered had a piece last month about these Zoom call eviction hearings. Mm-hmm. So the courts are reopening, but it's not in person. So in order to take part in an eviction case, you have to join via Zoom.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a trend that we are absolutely concerned about. You know, traditionally, housing courts are a place where social distancing is not possible. Tenants and landlords and lawyers sit shoulder to shoulder as they run through cases very quickly. So as the courts think about reopening, or have already reopened in many parts of the United States, you know, the courts are adapting to try and, you know, reestablish business as usual. But, you know, many, many families in the United States do not have access to stable internet, still not treated as a public utility. And so, you know, I already have difficult, you know, working on Zoom with my 91-year-old grandmother, much less, you know, someone who, you know, someone who's evicted, you know, probably also does not have the type of internet that, you know, would support, you know, participating in a courtroom hearing. But, you know, we're also receiving reports of other, you know, courts that are reopening for in-person hearings and are adapting in other ways. So in Columbus, Ohio, for instance, the court system has moved into a convention center so that they can move through the docket of evictions. And, you know, given the public health and economic crisis that we're in that is not over, you know, efficiency in evicting families should not be a priority right now, even if the court is working in a socially distanced way.
Well, and to highlight one of these, the stories in this NPR piece, they focus on Dina Brooks, who has a heart condition in Texas. She said, she told the judge in a Zoom hearing, "My company closed due to the pandemic. I haven't been able to get unemployment or anything." She told NPR, "I'm scared. They'll throw everything I have outside on the street. I have nowhere to go. I feel very depressed, very stressed out, and I don't know what to do." You know, in some cases, there were funds for renters, but they got taken up within days. For example, in May, Houston had in some cases, they got taken up in minutes. Houston had a $15 million rental assistance program, and it filled up in 90 minutes.
You know, that actually has been a fairly typical experience of what we're seeing as states and municipalities around the country make emergency rental assistance possible. Even before the pandemic hit, only 1 in 4 eligible families living below the poverty line received rental assistance in the United States. 1 in 4. So, you know, as the United States has long underfunded housing supports, you know, seeing year after year decreases in housing budgets since the Reagan administration. So now that we're, you know, thinking about how to respond to the pandemic, you know, we absolutely need, you know, a very generous response and one that lasts for the duration of both the public health and economic crisis.
In 2018, 1 in 4 renters put more than half of their income towards rent. Half of renters have less than $1,000 in savings. So a lot of people are paying their rent, but they're really living on the edge.
Yes, absolutely. And I often say that the rent eats first. You know, families are smart and they have been prioritizing paying rent over paying other types of, you know, important household needs. We've seen a 2,000% increase in food pantry requests, a 92% increase in rental assistance requests, and families are now turning to using credit cards and loans to, you know, keep a roof over their head. And we knew prior to the pandemic that 44% of American families would struggle to cover a $400 emergency expense. And we're now in month 4 of an economic crisis. So really, you know, families are stretched thin and it's time for, you know, our government to step in and support people through this crisis.
And a lot of people say this really has to happen at all levels, but especially the federal level. And I noticed that some Democrats are tweeting about this. Elizabeth Warren said, "We can and must stop mass evictions. Congress must pass my universal eviction moratorium bill to guarantee families won't lose their homes and pass Senator Sharon Brown's emergency rental assistance bill." Bernie Sanders says, "There must be an immediate nationwide moratorium on evictions, foreclosures, and utility shutoffs." Kamala Harris tweeted about one of her bills, which would provide people $2,000 a month throughout this crisis. What's going to happen? I mean, Julian Castro says Trump and McConnell are sitting on their hands as millions and millions of people are likely to face an eviction soon.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he is right. We are watching a standoff happen in Congress. There are, you know, multiple bills in the House and in the Senate that would start to address the housing crisis that we're in. And yet, you know, I also saw a tweet by Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, which is also absolutely true, that the only housing that we guarantee in this country is to people who are in prison. You know, so as we, you know, weather and emerge from this crisis, if I'm being optimistic, you know, I really would like to see us question why it is that that the United States does not, you know, provide a right to housing. You know, that is not something that that we have to do, but that we absolutely should do, and that, you know, many of our neighboring countries do to ensure the health and well-being of their citizens.
Well, Aliza, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Aliza Durana is a journalist and media strategist with Princeton University's Eviction Lab. That's a research team that published the first data set of evictions. According to the Oklahoma Policy Institute, as of yesterday, 4,173 evictions were filed in court in Oklahoma. Another 1,236 evictions were upheld. So as we are speaking, people are losing their homes. Up to 28 million people could be evicted. And coming up after a break, we'll continue talking about what needs to happen to ensure that people stay in their homes. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Dee Watkins about his new book, We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. He writes about the experiences of poor Black people on the streets of East Baltimore, including his own, who are usually ignored by the public, the media, and some social movements. He says in order for the lives of Black people living in poor communities to improve, they need to be heard. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show about evictions, if you have any questions or comments or a personal story, what is happening in your area? Is a moratorium still in place? And really just overall, what are your thoughts about this crisis? It happened long before COVID, but COVID is just making it even worse. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Now we would like to welcome Deborah Thrope to the show. Deborah is Deputy Director of the National Housing Law Project. Deborah joined as staff attorney in June 2013. Her work focuses on policy advocacy to preserve federally subsidized housing and tenants' rights in the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher and Public Housing Program. She provides training and technical assistance to advocates working with tenants, and she's based in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, Deborah, unfortunately, these evictions are already happening as we're speaking. They're happening, and up to 28 million people could lose their homes. What are your overall thoughts on this huge eviction crisis?
Sure. So, as Aliza from Eviction Lab pointed out, we were already in an affordable housing crisis prior to COVID. Right? We knew even before the virus outbreak, over 11 million families were paying upwards of 50% of their income on housing. And of course, many of these families were living in poverty, and a reduction in income and job loss can easily make these families vulnerable to housing instability, evictions, and homelessness. So enter COVID-19, when we know starting in about March, about 40% of people living in households making less than $40,000 a year lost their jobs, right? So that was the straw that broke the camel's back for many of these families. So people that were already living on the edge are now very much at risk of eviction. And so we've been calling it a tsunami, because we anticipate that the moment these moratoriums are lifted, and there are moratoriums in a number of areas, but the moment they're lifted, we really fear for families across the country that will be facing eviction, certainly housing instability, but potentially homelessness.
Right. And we talked about some of these moratoriums and what's happening around the country. 20 states, including Louisiana, Texas, Colorado, and Wisconsin, have lifted their restrictions, and eviction bans in 9 other states are going to expire at the end of this month. Diane Yentl tweeted, she's with the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She says, Ohio's COVID-19 cases increased 63% in 2 weeks. The state never had an eviction moratorium. They have turned the convention center into an eviction court to allow evictions to proceed while social distancing. She writes the irony. So in some states, they never even had an eviction moratorium.
That's right. And those are states that are facing, you know, they have been facing many evictions for many families. And, you know, it is ironic. And I agree with Diane that, you know, tenants shouldn't be carrying the weight of this pandemic on their shoulders. I mean, this is a problem that all families are facing and that we all have a responsibility to strategize around solutions. And so the fact that tenants in many of these areas that never even had a moratorium are really the ones that are the most vulnerable and seeing the impact of this pandemic is just, it's problematic on many levels.
Yeah, I mean, the United States, you know, was warned about COVID back on January 31st. That's when the first call came in, the first very serious call. And we did a lot of shows about this, knowing that this crisis was going to just really explode. When you look at local, state, and federal politicians, where does the action and the change really need to happen?
Sure. I mean, I think in many ways we have to see change on a federal level. You know, we saw some tenant relief, of course, in the last stimulus package. The CARES Act did provide this very limited eviction moratorium, but it is a moratorium that applies to, I think the Atlanta Fed's estimated between 28% to 45% of occupied rental units nationally. And that could have a huge impact for families. And, you know, we may see additional assistance in the House actually passed the HEROES Act. So if Senate moves on the next stimulus package, we could see a near universal moratorium. But an important piece of this is also rental assistance for families, right? So all moratoriums do is put a pause on rent payments. It doesn't cancel the rent for those families. So on top of the moratoriums, we also need to see the federal government act and provide funding for rental assistance for families that can't pay rent for COVID-related reasons and won't be able to, you know, if it's ongoing.
And as we mentioned earlier, some cities did have rental assistance, but it was used up in some cases in minutes.
We've been hearing the same reports, unfortunately, from advocates across the country. So we have an administer network of about 1,500 legal services advocates who are really on the front line of this eviction problem. And we have been hearing that over and over again. When there was rental assistance, it ran dry within a matter of minutes, hours. So we do hope that the Senate acts and provides, there's additional funding for rental assistance in the HEROES Act that was passed on May 15th by the House. But I will say the funding needs to come from the federal government, but there are a number of steps that state and local governments could do to help protect renters as well. And we've seen some state and local governments really step up. There are other funding mechanisms for these rental assistance programs. For example, states in the last stimulus package were granted money through a coronavirus relief fund, and we have seen some states step up and use those funds to help families pay their rent.
Well, if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about the eviction crisis happening in this country. It started before COVID, but it's just gotten worse because of COVID. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What is happening in your area? Is there a moratorium? If you have any questions or comments or a story to share, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Philip writes, what about the ultra rich? Are any of them doing their part? They have the money to create crisis centers for evicted families. Anything happening on the part of the vaunted private sector or super rich individuals?
So that's a great question. We have seen some foundations, for example, private funders step up to collaborate with local and state governments to help address the needs of renters right now. So we've seen that in a number of different contexts in different jurisdictions. But of course, we'd love to see more action on the part of private foundations and individuals.
I mean, Deborah, it is the level of inequality in this country just continues to widen. I mean, if you're at this point, you've got one in four renters putting half of their income towards rent. Half of renters have less than $1,000 in savings. At the same time, you've got, you know, billionaire wealth is just drastically increasing during the COVID crisis. As of April 15th, Jeff Bezos's fortune increased by about $25 billion. And then you have a major change in taxes. According to the Institute for, I just want to get their name right, Institute for Policy Studies, measured as a percentage of their wealth, the tax obligations of U.S. billionaires decreased 79% between 1980 and 2018. So can you just talk about these discrepancies and just so much work really needs to, so much change really needs to be done to address these crises?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, again, this pandemic has really just elevated many of the systemic problems in our system that existed before coronavirus. So this inequality, of course, is always there. And frankly, with respect to renters versus homeowners, right? I mean, Congress was quick to act to protect homeowners, whereas they were a little slower to implement some of these protections for tenants. And so, you know, important tenant protections. And again, you know, we think that landlords and tenants, homeowners and tenants should be sharing this responsibility right now. And the weight of the pandemic should not be solely on the back of tenants already paying, you know, a huge portion of their income in rent.
And according to reports, landlords are also pushing for more assistance. A lot of landlords say, I do not want to evict my tenant. We have a great relationship, but we also need help when it comes to paying our mortgage.
Right. And so, and that's absolutely right. And I, you know, we always recommend that tenants, you know, one of our first pieces of advice is that tenants and landlords should be communicating right now, because it might not be that the landlord wants to evict you. It might be that they have a mortgage to pay. Now, it's important to remember, though, that there are assistance programs available for landlords. For example, there's a number of forbearance programs. The landlord could potentially ask for a forbearance, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac just came out and said, listen, if you're going to access forbearance, then the tenant is actually protected during that time, right? And so during the terms of the repayment period, that individual tenant cannot be evicted. So, you know, I think we'll see, you know, hopefully landlords and tenants working together at this time. You know, landlords saying, you know, providing direct assistance to tenants, helping tenants understand where the rental assistance programs are in their locality.
What advice would you give to tenants? There have been many stories about tenants negotiating with their landlords, tenants asking landlords, especially when we're talking, I mean, there's a difference, we should say, between the mom and pop landlord, the neighborhood landlord who's had the place, you know, for generations, and then the corporate landlord who owns lots and lots of apartments. So there are major differences there. What advice would you give to tenants?
Sure. So the advice I would give to tenants is, first, people need to understand that, you know, I know on the show today you've talked a lot about the different moratorium in place throughout the country. Moratorium are not rent cancellation, right? Moratorium are just a pause. So when tenants can pay the rent, it's probably a good idea to pay the rent, because at the end of the moratorium, that rent will be due. The second piece of advice I would give is really to communicate with your landlord. And as you said, it might be an individual who owns one house, or it might be a large multifamily landlord who rents to a lot of different people. But in either case, it's important to reach out, communicate with your landlord, because there's a lot that can happen during that communication. I mean, the landlord is really free to negotiate a number of terms for the tenant when it comes to repayment, when it comes to, letting somebody out of a lease, right? And so if somebody can't pay their rent anymore, it might be that they need to, legally terminate the lease. And so communication is key, and it is true that the communication will look a little bit different based on who your landlord is. But the third piece of important advice I would give is really to seek emergency rental assistance if you need it. So there are, you know, there are some programs that have run dry, but there are, you know, most legal services or social service organizations in your area will know where the emergency rental assistance is and how to access it. And if you need it, it's in your best interest to identify the program and apply for it. The last thing I will say on this is that because these laws are, I mean, we have a patchwork of protections right now all over this country. There are federal protections. It's very hard to figure out whether or not they apply in your situation, and then there's state and local protections. Talk to a lawyer if you do receive any type of notice right now, any type of non-payment for rent notice, any eviction notice. Call a local legal services office or a local attorney.
Today we're speaking with Deborah Thrope, Deputy Director of the National Housing Law Project. She focuses on policy advocacy to preserve federally subsidized housing and tenants' rights in the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher and public housing programs. Today we are talking about the eviction crisis happening right now in this country. Up to 28 million renters could lose their homes because of the COVID pandemic and really also other issues. But what we're seeing right now is some moratoriums are starting to expire. Courts are opening. Eviction cases are happening. And if you have any questions or comments in our remaining minutes of the show, or if you have a story to share, if you're a renter or a landlord, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Jean who says, I'm sitting here listening to your show while doing my federal income taxes. We own a residential rental, and as I calculate our taxes, I see clearly how the deck is stacked for property owners. Last year, we received over $30,000 in rent, but due to our expense deductions, which includes depreciation, I'm reporting over $8,000 in losses. Without depreciation, I'd be paying tax on almost $11,000 in profit. Meantime, the house has appreciated in value, not depreciated. We can deduct mortgage interest, taxes, and insurance, and depreciate improvements. She cannot deduct her rent. Our tenant's business was closed due to the virus. We have no intention of evicting her, but it weighs on me how unfair the system is. We hope to hang in with her as long as we can. Wow. Jean, thank you so much for your story. Thanks so much for sharing. What are your thoughts, Deborah? Deborah? Did we lose Deborah?
Hello?
Oh, hi. There you are.
Okay. Sorry.
Go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Thank you, Jean, for that story, because I think, you know, that just provides an excellent example of exactly as Jean said, that the deck is just stacked against the tenants from day one. There's no renters, you know, tax deduction. And so those are some of the policies that, you know, are on the table and have been on the table by people like Elizabeth Warren, for example. And you mentioned some other lawmakers earlier in the show that are really thinking through how to address this issue and how to sort of equalize the field between, you know, with the tenants and the homeowners, because homeowners get a lot of breaks. They get a lot of tax breaks, exactly as Jean said. And there is just nothing like that for tenants. And a lot of us are tenants. And so we need to, you know, do what we can to really, really make this improve the system for renters across the country.
Well, thanks again for writing in, Jean. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. San Francisco has two-thirds of San Francisco residents are renters. 50% of California residents are renters. And yet, in San Francisco, that is, our congressperson, Nancy Pelosi, who is much loved, but she's done absolutely nothing. It seems like renters are, and people generally, are an afterthought. Large corporations and businesses get first choice. They get attention by her and even the Democrats and Republicans, and individuals, working class people, renters particularly. As I said, two-thirds of San Franciscans are renters, and yet there's nothing in the first couple of stimulus plans. So what's with that? I am certainly going to be backing Shahid Buttar because I think he'll actually do something for the constituents of the city. In fact, this city voted for universal health care back in the 90s, and she has resisted it all that time. Mm. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We're actually going to try to get Shahid Buttar and Nancy Pelosi to join the show. Shahid Buttar is running against Nancy Pelosi, and according to the latest numbers, I think he's already raised $1 million. Deborah, what are your thoughts about what Nancy Pelosi is or is not doing on this issue?
Yeah, so I think this issue, I mean, broadly has been ignored by lawmakers in Washington for a very long time. I mean, luckily, and thanks to the Eviction Lab and Matt Desmond, who I know were on the call earlier, you know, the book Evicted went a long way. It was an excellent portrayal of just the systemic problems with the system for renters. And so we have seen a number of lawmakers show interest in this issue and in really tackling it in the past few years, I will say. And so there's a number of federal proposals on the table trying to protect, further protect renters on a national level. Now, I will say one of the most important things that people can do right now is to really push the Senate to pass a version of the HEROES Act that includes this near universal moratorium. I mean, that's something that will help tenants in the short term, and also advocate for, you know, in the HEROES Act, the House version of the HEROES Act, additional funding for emergency rental assistance and emergency vouchers. But I completely agree that the needs of renters has really been ignored by Congress for quite some time. And, you know, this same on a state and local level. I mean, when you look who lawmakers historically are, they're homeowners, right? They're not renters. And so, you know, it's really important that that people speak out. And, you know, again, in the past few years, we have seen a number of proposals on the table that would greater assist renters, things like a right to counsel, for example, because right now we know the eviction problem, one of the reasons the eviction problem is so is so severe is because such a large percentage of landlords are represented versus tenants, right? And so tenants a lot of times don't even go into court because what's that, you know, what's it worth? And so we've seen some really creative proposals around providing right to counsel in eviction cases, and proposals such as that would really help renters in the long run.
Well, thank you for the call. It's a very important point. Before we end, I want to make sure we spend a little bit of time talking about people who live in public housing. The CARES Act banned landlords from issuing notices to tenants in federally funded housing to vacate until July 25th, which is in a couple of weeks. What is happening with people who live in federally funded housing?
Okay, so the CARES Act does provide eviction moratorium for non-payment of rent. So people in federally assisted housing can't be evicted specifically for non-payment of rent. And it's not just federally assisted housing like we think about public housing and Section 8 voucher holders. It's also tenants living in buildings where owners have certain types of federally backed mortgages. So it's a bit broader than the Atlanta feds, I believe, estimated that it covers between about 28 to 45% of occupied rental units. So, you know, it is true that the moratorium does expire on July 24th, which means on July 25th, tenants living in those properties could, in fact, receive an eviction notice. Now, there is some padding here, which is that the notice has to be at least a 30-day notice. So whereas tenants could receive the notice on July 25th, it would have to allow for at least 30 days prior to an eviction. So it could be, and, you know, and the notices will vary based on state law. So this is going to be something that looks very different across the country. But there is a little bit of extra time, but that's why passing the HEROES Act is so important because we need to extend that moratorium. The pandemic is not over. It's nowhere near over. Tenants are facing all of the same issues as they did, you know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. So we need the moratorium extended on a national level.
Anything else you would say about how people can get involved? I mean, it's hard to think that bill is even going to move with Mitch McConnell in charge, unfortunately.
Yes. I mean, hopefully lawmakers start hearing from tenants in their jurisdiction that are either beginning to face evictions because the moratoriums are lifted, they never had one, or they're scared, right? They're scared that they will be facing eviction in the near future because of job loss and income loss. So the best thing that people can do now is really call their senators to advocate to get something to move. I mean, you know, the crisis isn't over. There has to be there has to be more assistance specifically for tenants to avoid, you know, this sort of tsunami that we are anticipating, and frankly that all of the attorneys in our network are very much gearing up for this huge wave of evictions that we see coming.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Deborah Thrope is Deputy Director of the National Housing Law Project, and we have a number of resources on our website if you'd like to read more about this. Up to 28 million people could lose their homes because of job losses tied to COVID. So we will continue to follow this and do follow-up shows in the coming weeks and months. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. And I hope you can join us for our conversation with Dee Watkins tomorrow about his new book, We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.